Welcome to another episode of Murder, Inc. And I'm your host, Dead Bug, your concierge to the abyss. What makes murder so intriguing? Is it the fact that out of all that we encounter as sentient beings, it is the one thing that we have no control over and will always come without warning? Even death is something that we may often know is imminent, whereas murder hits like a sledgehammer while we sleep. Are we drawn to it like a fly to a windscreen? Is it that fear that we can be randomly taken? It can happen at any time, giving us no chance to wrap up loose ends, kiss our children goodbye, loved ones. It comes and viciously takes. Such is the case of funeral home director Dan O'Connell and his student intern, James Ellison. Both men were brutally murdered and cut down at a day at work at the funeral home, doing whatever, interns and funeral directors do at a funeral home. What made it bizarre was that neither man seemed to have an enemy in the world, and the killing seemed so random, and the way the bodies were positioned, like they didn't see it coming. And investigators agree that whoever took the duo down was a dead-eye aim, and the killing was clean. It was around 1:40 p.m. when local police received a phone call from Marty Shanklin, a fat, balding man in his mid-30s, who works for the St. Croix County Medical Examiner, who seems to sweat no matter how cold it is, and prefers licking the whipped cream off the donuts than sticking his tongue between the legs of any woman he's had or ever gonna have. Many people speculate that his wife has to dress up as a donut before he fucks her. But when he stumbled across the bodies, one of them being his best friend, Fat Boy finally lost his appetite. As with the whole town of Hudson St. Croix, when they were to find out that they lost two of their popular residents. When everybody heard about the deaths, there wasn't a glass of water poured around the water cooler that didn't say it was some sort of sick fag homo thing. Older boss, young intern, guiding hand, you know the score. But it turns out that both of their dicks were shit free, and they were as clean as a sole on a cripple's boot. And besides, investigators chased it up, even staked out the local homo bars, and nothing came of it. With the FBI now involved, they investigated several leads, including a cult that was against embalming and stuffing the stiffs, and they'd sent several threatening letters to all the funeral homes in the Twin Cities. But it was a lead that went nowhere. Hudson St. Croix was a town in mourning, and they certainly had to thank their local priest for getting them all through it. Me, I'd say that's their fucking job, and just shut up and do it, and let's stop laying praise on them. But I guess I'm a glasses half full type of guy, and the priest was doing a good job. Now, Father Ryan Erickson, although still young, 31 years old, he was a fire and brimstone type of preacher, casting on about hell and premarital sex and everything that was fun. But regardless, people liked him, and he pulled them through the tragedy. It was almost 2 years later that investigators almost given up, and they were in the office watching a ball game, when someone walked in and blew the case wide open. This episode of Murder, Inc. is brought to you by Be Free Tampons. Remember, not all bleeding has to do with murder. So ladies, scoop them up, and there's a 2-for-1 deal if you mention my podcast. I'm just messing with you, trying to relieve the tension of the podcast. Now let's get into part two. It was on a Tuesday night where Detective Knobs and Petty were in their office cooling the heels watching the ball game when a young man entered into their office. He had something to tell them, or report. I guess it was up to them how they'd want to take it. But he had a tale to tell them about one priest named Father Erickson. The 20-year-old told the cops that in his teens, he spent a lot of time with Father Ryan, and he was a real swell guy, and always invite him and his friends over to the Priory, where he lived with a few of the other priests. And he liked to give him and his teenage friends booze, let them listen to music in his apartment. And one time, he got real drunk. When he woke up, he was naked, and he was laying in bed next to Father Ryan. Without going into too much detail, apparently the room smelled like shit and he had a sore ass. But as I said, this is a family podcast, and I don't want to go into too much detail if you don't mind. And I ain't asking. And he told the cops that this happened on more than one occasion. It also happened to his friends. And that they lovingly called Father Erickson Father Shitstick. The 20-year-old said he'd complained to the parish, and that they transferred Erickson out of town for a bit. But he was back again. And that the reason he was complaining to the cops, because he was worried it'd happen again. Because Shitstick was back in town. Now the two investigators, with time on their hands, because the funeral home murders had hit a brick wall, figured they'd check out the kid's claims and look into Father Erickson's background. When they did, they were shocked with what they found. There were numerous cases of reports against him, sticking his dick in young boys, as early as 1994. And instead of the church doing anything about it, they just kept moving Erickson around to a brand new hunting ground. Erickson was still in priest school when one of the other students complained that he'd woken up with Erickson hanging out of his ass. And when the victims tried to have Father Erickson charged, the district attorney investigated it, and after 4 months, they concluded that there weren't enough evidence to prove that Father Erickson was sticking his holy love stick up teenage boys' asses. The district attorney made a statement saying that the priest's actions did not seem to be sexually predatorial, and that in an overall study, it did not affect his good character and the good that he had done within the community, and concluded by saying that he wasn't a high risk within the community and church. The prosecutors also ordered a psychological examination that concluded that, believe it or not, Father Erickson was heterosexual. And they concluded their investigation by saying the wannabe priest was good to go back to preschool. Makes you wonder what it takes for a priest to get kicked out of school. I got expelled from high school for fucking a girl in the change rooms. Erickson went on to be ordained as a Catholic priest. It was from there that he was assigned to St. Patrick's Church in Hudson's St. Croix. And it was now 2004, and he'd become a beloved spiritual leader. When detectives contacted Father Erickson, he seemed surprised that they wanted to meet him, but he agreed to come into the station. It was December of 2004 when the priest entered the station to talk to the detectives. Detectives Knobs and Petty started the conversation, offering the priest a chair and a cup of java. Then moved right into it, asking about serving underage teens alcohol, and to be more specific, the teen who made the complaint. But Father Erickson, well, he seemed unshaken. And yeah, he admitted giving the young teen a couple of beers because he himself remembered liking a drink when he was that age before he found the good Lord. And then he went on to say that although he may not have made the best decision, he'd done nothing wrong in the eyes of the Lord. And that the teen's mother knew about it, and she was okay with it. And police thought they'd shake it up a bit, and asked the priest if the boy had ever got so drunk that he'd passed out. And Erickson sat there, leaning back in his chair, nursing his cup of java, and said, "You know, some people don't like instant coffee. They think it's the lazy man's drink. But little do they know that it's made with some of the world's finest coffee beans. For me, it's mother's milk." And then, Erickson, like he's reading off a script, answered the investigator's question. He recalled a time when the young teen got drunk and passed out, and then he puked on himself. To which the priest had to undress the teen and shower him, then put him to bed. He then smiled and told the detectives that it's a little known fact that Jesus regularly bathed his apostles. Both detectives felt, although the priest was relaxed, He was clearly giving them the high hat, and he was hiding something. And when he asked the detectives if they had any Danishes, he was pushing their buttons, so they decided to shake things up. That's when they asked him what he knew about the O'Connell funeral home murders. Erickson was cool as a cucumber and said that he'd counseled the families through their grief, and he'd also spoken at the funeral, and that the two men were now most certainly in the fields of glory. To which Petty replied, "I'm sure they are, but I bet you they wish they were down here with the rest of us heathens for a little longer." To which Erickson replied, "The Lord works in mysterious ways." To which Detective Knobs interjected, "It was a hell of a way to go, wasn't it?" Then the priest went on to describe the positions of the bodies. He also mentioned that both men had been shot in the head, and there were 3 shots fired, and all of them hit their target. The detectives paused, and then they looked at each other, because they knew the information had never been released, even to the families. When they questioned the coffee-loving priest on where he got his information, priest said he must have heard it around the parish, or the gossip, or when he was talking to some of the other officers. These sort of things travel. And he smiled and asked the detectives for a refill on his coffee. As they topped up the God Lover's cup, they then asked him where he was between 12:30 and 2:30 on the day of the murders. That the priest couldn't remember. As they concluded the interview and talked a bit about baseball and walked the priest to the door, it was then that Detective Knobs asked, "If you did commit the crime and murdered these two men, would you tell us? Would you confess?" The priest smiled and he said, "It's human nature to lie. But me being a man of God, of course I would have to confess if I wanted to get into heaven." The priest walked at the door. He got into his car, and he drove away. The detectives knew that something didn't smell right, and it weren't the fancy hairspray that the priest used to keep his hair so tidy. So they went and started doing a little poking around, and talked to the family of the victims, and employees of the funeral home, and friends, asking if they'd accidentally leaked the details of the crime to the priest, or in fact anyone else. And they all swore their lips had been tighter than a nun's pussy. After this, the detectives started going and talking to Father Erickson's close friends and people he worked with. One of those friends was Russell Lundgren, a deacon at the church, and by all accounts, the priest's best friend. And he told the detectives about an incident that pricked their curiosity. He said that one evening that him and Erickson had been watching the ball game, having a few beers, and that Erickson, out of the blue, said he did it, and they were going to get him for it. When he asked Erickson to explain himself, Erickson said he was only joking and to forget about it. Lundgren said that he prayed for his friend and figured that it was some kind of guilt because he'd heard about the accusations that he'd been fucking teenage boys. But he told his wife about it and a few of the parishioners in the church, and they all prayed for the father. When detectives traveled to the next county and started talking to a few of the members of the priest's parish and some of the teenage boys that had made the accusations against the priest, one of them told a tale about how the priest had been heavily drinking in his apartment and got drunk and pulled out his gun and was aiming it at the church, pointing it and pretending to fire at members of the parish that he disliked. When the detectives contacted Father Erickson and asked if he'd be willing to take a polygraph test, Father agreed, but it was the next day. A lawyer phoned representing the Catholic Church, and he said the priest wouldn't be attending. It was 3 days later that Hudson police served a search warrant to search the church and the rectory where Erickson lived. But surprise, surprise, when they arrived, the priest weren't in. They took his computers, some videotapes, documents, and his clothing. And in those documents, they found a last will and testament, and a letter that he wrote saying that he didn't commit the murders, and that there was no DNA tying him to the scene, and that his guns could not be linked either. Which seemed like an odd thing for an innocent man to say, opposed to being angry and saying, "I didn't do it." They also subpoenaed Erickson's personnel file from the church. The detectives now began re-interviewing everyone they had in the weeks following the murders. And behind closed doors, they admitted to each other that it just may have been some sick fuck fag thing that caused the two men's deaths. It was on a Sunday morning, the 19th of December, almost 3 weeks after the detectives had first questioned Father Erickson, that parishioners, arriving for Sunday service, were met by the horrific sight of a naked body hanging off a fire escape, twitching. Located between Erickson's apartment and the church that he preached, the God-man had hanged himself. In his room, they found a suicide note. In it, he said that he'd lived a hard but exciting life. And he learned, and he taught. I loved people. I hurt them. But I never killed anyone. My ego, my lust, my envy have always stopped me from being the man that I could have been. And now, I'm tired. Oddly enough, the note didn't mention about him ass-fucking any kids. But I guess you wouldn't expect it to. For the two detectives, they took this letter as an admission of guilt. But there were still loose ends they had to tie up. Why'd he kill him? Was it a sick fuck fag thing? Were they all getting busy? Jealousy? Were him and Dan fighting over James? That part was still unsolved, and they intended to solve it. When the detective subpoenaed the diocese to get further information, they found out that Erickson admitted being sexually abused when he was only 4 years old. And in turn, had abused other children. And when he was 14 years old, he was cautioned by police for ass-fucking a 5-year-old. He'd also been known to have an explosive temper and a problem with alcohol. And the diocese said he'd had a history of abusing animals, blowing up fish and squirrels at church camp. He even burnt out his own dog's eye with a lit cigarette. Now detectives knew it had something to do with ass-fucking, and all they had to do was follow the shit trail to the priest's motive. They also found more damning evidence on the dead priest's computer. There was a file called Holy Lord's Prayers. When they opened it, it was full of child porn, teenage boys fucking and whatnot. And although his guns didn't match the gun used for the murder, what they had was a pedophile priest with a hair-trigger temper who liked ass pussy. But did he like it enough to kill for it? So why would he kill Dan O'Connell and James Ellison? Everything seemed to point to some sort of homo-love triangle, with Ellison being the pointy bit, if you get my drift. And maybe Dan wanted to get involved. Some sort of creepy threesome. They got into an argument, and then the priest introduced him to God early. But by all accounts, when they questioned Dan O'Connell and James Ellison's friends, they were both as straight as a retard's boner. Neither of them liked ass pussy, so the pieces just didn't fit. And they couldn't link the horny priest to the murders. But it was in February of 2005 that a bus driver came forward with information that would blow the case wide open. After the priest hanged himself, stories started going around town that he was the killer, and that it had been a love triangle that had gone bad. Mary Pagnell, who'd known Dan since they were kids, in fact, he was the one who popped her cherry. Well, she came forward and she said that she'd remembered a conversation that she'd had with Dan on the morning that he were murdered. She'd attended the same church as Father Erickson and Dan O'Connell, and when she ran into O'Connell at Kmart, she could see something was heavy on his mind. And he asked Mary, in her capacity for the church as their bus driver, if she'd ever seen anything odd. Anything strange about Father Erickson, and if he'd ever acted inappropriately with the children. She said that she'd never seen the priest doing anything out of sorts or anything that would raise her suspicions, but it was quite obvious that Erickson favored the boys over the girls. And then she advised Dan to stay out of it, and if he had a problem, to go to the police first. But Dan O'Connell weren't the type of man to tread lightly, and he told her that he was going to handle it in his own way and confront the horny priest later that afternoon about his concerns and suspicions. It was 11:15 that day that Mary says she saw Father Erickson leaving the diocese and he weren't wearing his priest outfit, wearing his street clothing. When police gave her a polygraph test, she passed with flying colors. This now gave police a motive. Father Erickson had gone to the funeral home to shut O'Connell up from exposing him from being the filthy pedophile that he was. And James, the kid, he won his lover. He won his ass pussy. He were collateral damage. He just happened to be there, and he took a bullet for it. Two, if you want to be precise. Nitpick. The detectives now constructed a timeline to link the horny priest to the funeral home murders. Dan O'Connell were well hooked up into the community. He was a member of the choir, the bowling club, a scout leader. He even volunteered at the YMCA. There was a rumor going around about a priest fucking kids. He would have heard about it. And if a young man needed to confide with someone about a priest who fucked asses, Dan O'Connell, again, would have been that man. By all accounts, he was a good man who helped others. And he wouldn't have taken lightly to a priest helping themselves to the cookie jar. When they checked police records, it clearly shows that O'Connell had phoned Father Erickson. If O'Connell knew that Erickson was still ass-fucking, if it was divorced, it would be a secret that would destroy the man of God's career. Investigators now believe that Dan O'Connell phoned the horny father and summoned him for a talk over at the funeral home, but didn't say what that talk was about. But Father Erickson wasn't no fucking idiot. He knew what it were about, and he came armed. So I'm guessing he went to that funeral home knowing what he had to do. And he walked into Dan O'Connell's office, where he was sitting in his chair at his desk, and he put a bullet through his head, killing him instantly. And as Erickson was leaving, James entered the office. And he saw his mentor laying on the floor bleeding, and he ran to help him. And this is when Erickson put a bullet in his head with his 9mm semi-automatic. And with James's body still quivering, he put another bullet in him, just to make sure. A truck driver, who was eating at the local McDonald's, remembered seeing someone leaving the funeral home around this time wearing a pink t-shirt, which is unusual in Wisconsin. Later, the truck driver said he couldn't be 100% sure, but he figured there was a good chance the man in the pink shirt could have been Father Erickson. And although his parishioners said that Father Erickson had a history of wearing fruity shirts, no pink shirt were ever found. A janitor and one of the parishioners at the church said that Father Erickson came to the church about 2 p.m. and said that something tragic had happened at the funeral home, even though at this time, the police would have just been arriving at the crime scene, so no one would have had a clue what had happened inside. But he also told them that Dan O'Connell and his assistant had been shot, information that was not leaked at that time. So unless this priest were Kreskin, there was no fucking way he'd have access to this information. And oddly enough, it was at 3 o'clock when he was at the diocese, and there were some people talking about the murders. He acted surprised, like he hadn't heard of the crime yet. It was only hours after the murders that the father put on his priest outfit and went to the victims' families to comfort them in their time of need. Part of their most inner trusted circle, someone who provided comfort in a time of grief. But was he the killer? And in fact, he even read the scripture at Dan's funeral, which is the ultimate betrayal if he was their killer. It was 10 months later that a hearing was held at the St. Croix Court to decide whether the father had killed the two men in the funeral home. Father Erickson's family refused to attend the hearing, saying there was no way that the priest killed the two men. But there were 15 other men who showed up. All said that when they were teenagers, the priest and ass-fucked them. The presiding judge, Eric Mandel, said that he believed between 1 and 10, 10 being the most likely the murder were committed, 1 being the least likely. He said he believed it was 10 out of 10 that the horny fucking priest had murdered the two men. But to this day, there are many people who still champion Father Erickson's cause and say that there's no way he would have murdered anybody. But either way, the judge found the priest guilty of killing Dan O'Connell and James Ellison. The O'Connell and Allison's family tried to make something positive come from the tragedy and set about putting an act forward for reform in the Catholic Church so the priests won't fuck the kids anymore, which I think is highly unlikely ever going to happen, but yeah, at least they're trying. Now this concludes another episode of Murder, Inc. and an untimely death in a funeral home. And if I'm being honest here, I'm probably never gonna do one of these fucking podcasts again, cause they take too much work and people complain that I take too long. That's just the reality. So I'll see you next time that there's some ghastly murder that needs podcasting. Which hopefully will be never, because I did not enjoy making this particular podcast.